Hello and welcome to The Price of Music, the show that looks at the money behind the music industry with me, Steve Lamack, and Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge. Stuart, it's time for some more of our listeners' questions. Once again, we're going to dedicate this whole episode to some of the queries you've sent us. An interesting selection. Keep them coming. To start with, question from James Morris. I have a question about musicians and pensions. With one of my favourite bands, You, Me at Six, recently splitting up after 20 years, I started wondering, what do band members do for money once they quit or retire? Do record labels have a pension scheme they pay into? Do they have private pensions? Or do the members have financial advisors which help them set aside money for this scenario? Or can they survive on their Spotify streams? So working our way through this one. Thank you, James, for this. Stuart, record companies don't run pension schemes for artists, do they? I don't think. In fact, I went and checked this because we've got, I don't know if you know this, we've got a secret accountant.
Do we? Oh, that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, we've got a secret accountant who offered up his services for us a few weeks back, for which we are most grateful. So I can tell you, James, the secret accountant says no, record labels don't run pension schemes. And I'm guessing this is because although they're under contract for the record they're making or the records they're making for the record label, they're still essentially freelancers, I think. So the onus is on the musicians themselves to look after their money. And most of them, we think, don't have financial advisors because they're far too busy with their rock and roll lifestyle to bother with that kind of thing. Or at least they might have some finances to manage at some point, probably not early on in their career. Because as our secret accountant emphasized, a lot of artists at the beginning of their careers, when they're starting out, don't really have any money to spare. It's just when you get to the next level, when you get more successful, this is where, when there's more money swishing around, this is where you can start looking after your future financially. And one of the options, which apparently a lot of bands do, is that they form a limited company, which is a more tax efficient way of looking after their money and protecting their income. The only problem, though, with a band becoming a limited company, and the money that would go into that company is the money that all band members share. So it will be money from live recordings, live appearances and things like that. But the money goes into the limited company. The only problem, as anyone who's been a part of a limited company will know, is if your money is going through a limited company, it's very hard to take your money out without losing the benefits of being a limited company. But there one of the ways you can do it, though, is by paying into a pension, which you can do tax-free, up to a limit of, I think it's £60,000 a year, tax-free. So you can take the money out, put that into, set up your own pension, and that's apparently how come some musicians do have personal pensions. Otherwise, he was saying, you know, young artists, they're not interested in pensions. Mm. I mean, why would I, a young musician, want a pension which you can't touch till you're 55 years old? I mean, that seems like a long way off for a budding pop star, I would say, especially when, you know, said budding pop star believes that their catalogue of songs will end up being their pension and paying for them in their old age, which is where this question of streaming revenue comes in. Is streaming a pension of sorts? I suppose it depends how many records you've made, how much catalogue is online, and how enduring your appeal is. Mm. But can you make a living post-career out of streaming?
I mean, like you say, it's a long as a piece of string question because it depends how popular you are. But I mean, the one thing that we know about streaming is that what does work on there is a catalogue, when you've got a catalogue of music. So if you've retired, chances are you've had a lifetime of making music. So you might have 10 albums, 20 albums out there. And the idea of streaming is streaming doesn't suddenly stop because you've retired. So it will carry on. So yeah, in theory, whatever streaming income you're earning. And this is where, I mean, and this is maybe something that's more bigger bands, really, bigger artists. But this whole idea of managing your catalogue and managing your kind of your business carries on. So if you're not playing live regularly, if you're not releasing new albums, there's still a lot of stuff you can do to keep the stuff current, to kind of keep remastering stuff. So that's why we see, I think, a lot of bands who are no longer active in some senses, but they're still having their music promoted and put out there. So I think it's, but it's, I think it's, the other thing is, if you're a songwriter, do you ever retire? I mean, you know, you don't, I mean, as long as you can still write songs, as you can sit at the piano, sit with a guitar. So that's the other thing I think with musicians, that there is no, I'm not sure there is like a, it's not like you get to sort of 67 or whatever the age is now and go, right, I'm really fed up of doing music. I've been looking forward to doing no music at all. And I think, so I think musicians do assume they'll just carry on until they kind of shuffle off their clogs.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting you mentioned songwriters, because our secret accountant also made the point as well, which is that if you're the songwriter, you're probably going to be, well, you are going to be better off than some of the rest of the members of the band, the songwriter or songwriters in a band, unless you're like, I guess I think Blur is a famous example, who just split the money four ways. Otherwise, the songwriter is going to be earning more money than the rest of the band, because they'll be getting money for the publishing rights on the songs rather than just for the recordings. And and this is something which I hadn't thought about it like this. But when I was chatting to our accountant friend, he said, here's the irony. The massive pop stars who can afford to pay into a pension don't need a pension. But musicians who have, you know, a short-term or low-level career for a while, they're the ones who will struggle to meet pension contributions during their career, and they're the ones who actually need a pension. And they're probably the ones who are still gigging, as you say. You know, you can carry on. There is money to be made by playing live, and I think that's why time and again you see groups who have reformed, because the money's run out.
And the other thing as well, I mean, everything is cyclical, isn't it? Like there's a massive 90s revival at the moment, isn't there, in all kinds of ways, like hearing a lot of piano house bangers on Radio One and bands, and so that there's every possibility that a song you made 20 years ago, 30 years ago, will suddenly be covered by someone current, and then that's more money flowing in, you know, from nothing you've done. It's just that you've a song. So there's all this, I think, when you have a catalogue of music, it can suddenly become relevant in all kinds of different places, and that's where money comes in. But it's not really predictable, so it's not like it's like a pension where you sort of think, this is how much money I'm putting in and this is what it's worth. It's kind of, you know, windfalls, I suppose.
The professional advice was, start a pension if you can, even if it's only a small one, and if you do get a massive advance from a record company, or you have a really successful tour or a big hit, buy a house, then get a pension. And that'll be £1,000, please, for that advice. Only kidding. Doesn't stop there, though, does it? Because interestingly, some artists are thinking not just up to and past retirement age. It goes even further now.
It does, yeah. So one of my favourite things I've ever heard was when there was Dolly Parton's America podcast a few years ago. And she was interviewed in the final episode, and she said, she's got hundreds or even thousands of songs that haven't ever been recorded. And so what she's been doing is she's recording all this unreleased music to a click track with her vocals, so that future producers, and she said basically any producer in the world, a hot producer, when I'm gone, they could take my songs, just a click track and my vocal, and build a complete arrangement around that. So she's planning for when she's gone, this massive catalogue of unreleased music that people need. Elton John a few years ago was reportedly training an AI so that he could carry on writing songs and making music after he was dead. Which I haven't heard much about recently. And then we've got the whole ABBA avatars showing, and Kiss recently said I'm always wary when Kiss say they've stopped touring, because that seems to happen every 3 years or so, the final tour. And then, but Kiss are kind of saying, we're not touring anymore. We're going to have avatars playing gigs. So at the top end, like one of the top artists, there are all these ways you can investigate to kind of live on and carry on, even making new music after you're dead. And that's the ultimate pension scheme, I suppose, for your descendants.
That's Dolly Parton, who's from Tennessee.
Yes.
That's an in-joke if you listened to the last episode. question from Dan Hutch. I'm almost ashamed to ask this question, says Dan, but what exactly is an industry plant? as best I see it, it's a new artist that a large proportion of people seem to agree are very promising and are being written and talked about right from the start of their careers. Correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't this just good old-fashioned hype? I see it levelled at both major label artists, The Last Dinner Party, and indie-signed acts, Wet Leg. But what exactly are they being accused of? Are they test tube created artists who have been made, dreamt up by suits at record labels? I mean, surely that's a stretch of the imagination. Isn't it just good songs, good PR, and probably a well-respected manager? Stuart, I'm going to hand to you before I go off on some quite long rant about this. I'll confess for a start, I'd never even come across the term industry plant. I get the idea of what it is. Is that in regular usage? I thought I was reasonably up to date, but obviously not.
Well, so as a modern journalist, the first thing I do when I need to understand something, I go to Wikipedia. And thankfully, there's a big fulsome page about it. Yeah. So industry plant. I'm not going to just read out Wikipedia in this podcast because I've heard podcasts like that. They're terrible. But yeah, it's basically musicians who become popular through nepotism, inheritance, wealth, or connections in the music industry rather than their own merits. And they often present themselves as independent and self-made, and are alleged to have their public images manufactured for them by record labels. And apparently, it started in the early 2010s on hip hop focused message boards. And then in the late 2010s, it kind of started being weaponized against. And the two mentioned here are Clairo and Billie Eilish were kind of two of the first mainstream stars to get this leveled at them.
Right.
And this is the other thing I was going to say is you hear it a lot more about women and non-white musicians, which is kind of an interesting insight, I think, sometimes into why a term is being used and who's using it. Like it seems to be quite it's often misogynist going, I don't think Billie Eilish is a proper artist. So there's a bit of that, I think. But yeah, I mean, it seems to suddenly be a phrase that's in people's minds, isn't it? And on social media, someone breaks through and instantly there are 100 people on Twitter going, they're an industry plant. I'm fairly sure labels are behind all this.
Yeah, which, I mean, look, the thing is, you have to start off with this, you can't. I've been guilty of this, particularly when I first started writing, was believing that there was some justice in the music industry, that the music industry had an element of fairness, and the music industry doesn't. It's just not fair. So some bands will benefit where others won't from certain things. It's an uneven playing field. And that, I think, you kind of just have to accept is part of the game, really. But as for, I mean, for the bands mentioned, and I suppose it also comes back to, and it's, I don't know if this is old fashioned now, but we used to think at the NME that bands had to pay their dues before they were allowed any form of success. You had to be, or at least I did. If you hadn't gone round the country four times in the back of a rusty van, then what business have you becoming popular? Which is, I mean, it's ridiculous. But then again, this is sort of part of the same mentality, I think. It's like, well, where has this band come from? What have they done? They've had it easy. And some bands will and some bands won't. I mean, it also presumes this, the idea of an industry plant is that the industry knows what it's doing.
Exactly.
And has the power to do it. And yeah, if the music industry had the power to do these things, it would be doing it all the time. I mean, it probably is trying to launch things which they've created, but they, a lot of them just fail.
Well, that's it. Think of the artists that, and I don't know what your names are here, but the artists where, you know, there's a shed load of money from a big label gone into them and no one's been interested. Like, you can't guarantee. But it's weird. I mean, I think it's weird. Like to me, so Wet Leg, for example, signed to noted industry manipulating Behemoth Domino. It's very
the idea that Lawrence Bell, who runs Domino, is some sort of kingpin figure behind the music industry manipulating our tastes. I can't see that.
It's a weird thing, I think, because that one thing. So two things actually I thought to say about this. One is that things can move so fast nowadays. Like, you can have a song blow up on TikTok, And then you're being stuck into 2,000 capacity venues. So that idea of paying your dues, playing the kind of smallest venues and working your way up. Nowadays, that can be short-circuited by suddenly going viral on TikTok. And then here you are. And then people get cross because, like, well, they haven't kind of earned it. And where have they come from? And why have I not approved this? It is often people saying, why have I not approved this? Do you remember when Pink Pantheress first came through last year? And she was copying a lot of attacks. People saying, she's not playing live properly. Who is she? Where has she come from? Who's behind this? Because they didn't like her. And I sort of saw her performing recently on TV, and she's really good now, and she's got this crowd of people who are batshit for her. So what happened was, she was really good, but she just came from nowhere. And so some people were like, I smell a rat. And by the way, she's a woman, so I think it's doubly suspicious. Like, it's all that going on, I think.
That's exactly the point, I think. It's bands who appear to have had almost an overnight success. I mean, I can tell you the story with Wet Leg, that I went to see Wet Leg at a place called the Lexington, a little venue in London, the Lexington. They did a BBC introducing night after lockdown. And I bumped into Lawrence Bell, who runs Domino, in the queue outside. And I said, what are they like? I've not seen them. Obviously, we've played the record a lot. And he said, I haven't seen them either. So because of COVID, so he heard the track, and just thought it was really great. And so they did a deal before he'd actually even managed to see them play live. And I think they did the deal even before they had a manager, going back to the original question, well-respected managers, you know, do they pull all the strings? No, but they can really help. And Wet Leg are now managed by Martin Hall, who is probably best known for managing the Manic Street Preachers, amongst others. But even Martin will probably admit he's had successes and failures along the way, or if not failures, bands which haven't maybe achieved the level of success that he and they would have wanted. But that's sort of Wet Leg. And also, Wet Leg have been around individually, had been in lots of different bands on the Isle of Wight. And I think lots of people know about Rhiann, the singer's previous incarnations as a kind of indie Kate Bush type of singer. So, I mean, it finally, when it all clicks, then it can really capture people's imagination, and then it happens really quickly. But it's the suspicion of why it's happened really quickly. But along the way, there wasn't a Svengali along the way which made that happen. Last Dinner Party is a slightly different story. Although, again, they'd been playing around the London pub circuit for a while. But then they got signed by Island Records. But rather than rush them into putting a record out, they made sure they wanted to get the record right. So they were signed for a little while before the record came. And I think the album was probably done before they even released a single. So then it happens really quickly because the single comes out. And again, it seemed to capture a lot of people's imagination. And, you know, some bands are just in the right place at the right time. And I think they had the right look, the right sort of sound for the time. Certainly they were certainly a band which I think the media were hungry for. And then you have this thing which Damon Albarn describes as consensus terrorism, which is, you know, one radio station or one magazine will pick up on this band and say, this is going to happen. This is brilliant. And a really enthusiastic writer will go, this is great. This is the future. And then another writer will look at it and go, well, I don't want to be left behind. And they might not even like them that much, but they see that there's something going on here. So they write about them. Now you've got two playlists or two big articles about you. And then, of course, writer number three or the next magazine down the line or the next radio station are going, hang on a second, are we missing out here? We don't want to be playing catch up. We'll do it. And all of a sudden, here you are in a very short space of time. But yes, I think the fact that they were signed, made a record. Obviously, they made it with James Ford. So there is somebody that would cost you some money to hire. And I guess that this is the other thing, bringing it back to money, which is what our podcast is about. If Island Records have signed you, it gives you probably a bit of money and time to become good and to write more songs and to rehearse or to go off and play gigs, which if you are a self-funding musician, you just don't have. So it looks again, it looks like somebody's manipulating the situation. All they're doing is giving the space and the time and the money to the band to get on with being in a band. And they can't have been that well off, because the singer out of Last Dinner Party was working at Sister Ray Records in London, right up to the point where she went in to the shop one day, spoke to the boss and said, I'm going to have to pack it in. I'm really sorry. I'm going to have to hand in my resignation because we're supporting the Stones on Saturday.
Which is, that's a good resignation. But I think, yeah. This made me think about this whole very related debate that's not about industry plants, but when people worry about class in music and how are there barriers now to getting into music unless you are middle class, able to kind of live at your parents for free? Like, a lot of people talked about this idea of the worry that can working class bands get a foot in nowadays, and it's the same in acting and TV. Like, I remember, was it Christopher Eccleston recently? Or no, someone else talked about this idea of if any art is only accessible to people who are rich enough to be able to kind of spend that time not getting paid for it, that's a worry. So in a way, there's this discussion worrying about, are the barriers too high for people who aren't a certain level of wealth? And yet people who are banging about industry plants across that there's kind of female bands in the breaking through. It seems like maybe the priority should be elsewhere, looking at how do you widen that net as wide as possible so people can, who are good, so they can have that time, like you said, like getting signed by Island Records and having that time to develop. So how can we make sure as many people who are great have that as possible, rather than if someone does have that, accusing them of being an industry plant and they shouldn't be respected? It seems one of 17,000 reasons why social media is sometimes really frustrating, because it's the easiest thing to do.
Yeah, it's a very good point that about do you have the money to be able to create, to spend time working on your craft? And I think it has prevented certain bands. Because if you're a band and you have to, a lot of bands will be holding down jobs, and therefore their ability to go out and tour, for instance, is restricted by how much holiday they've got. And things like that. But I mean, some bands, if you're very, very determined, I guess there are still bands who are living off, cold sausage and mashed potato in a squat somewhere, who are, scraping together money, doing odd gigs here and there to progress their career. But no, that's a good point. And thank you very much, Dan. And it wasn't quite as bad a rant as I thought it was going to be. Dan Hutch, thank you. Question from Mark Robinson. How do radio stations compensate bands/artists for every play of their track? I recall reading somewhere it was so many pence per play. Is this correct? And has this rate ever increased over the years? It has slightly, I think. But let's do the mechanics first, and then we'll do the figures. So according to my source on this, there's two sets of payments you get for being played on the radio, which come via PRS, which is for the writers of the songs, and PPL for the performers. The PRS payments are dependent on not just the reputation of the station that you're being played on. It's all down to listening figures. So rates will go up and down depending on whether a radio station is doing well or not. But generally, the bigger the listenership of the radio station, the more money you'll get. So your target markets at the moment are the big commercial networks, if you can get on a daytime playlist, which gets played right across the country. Also BBC Radio 2, which is the biggest of the BBC pop stations, followed by Radio 1, and then the payments go down in scale down the line to Six Music and other digital-only stations. As for the precise figures, it's actually much harder to find out than I thought it was going to be, although I think they are listed on the PRS website, although I'm not a member of PRS, so I can't get on it. But I have got someone digging away for us to find the up-to-date numbers for you. I mean, somebody listening to this probably knows already if you can help us out. But the last set of figures that I found, corroborated by a friend of mine, I think it's a very rough guide, but we're saying somewhere around £70 for a 3-minute track on Radio 2, £50 for a 3-minute track on Radio 1. But as I say, we'll update you as soon as I get the latest figures. Interesting, though, I also asked about sessions. You know, if you're an artist, if you're one of those artists who are lucky enough to perform a session on the radio, and I'm not sure how this works in the commercial sector, but if you get invited in to do a session at the BBC, on top of your PRS payment for each of the songs, you'll get paid an additional session fee. And that's based on the musicians' union rates, which from April the 1st this year means that you will get something like £79 per member of the band if it's a full session up to 3 hours, or £65 each for a short session, which is up to 10 minutes. So that's £79. That's four of you, £79 each. And on top of that, if it's used again, you'll get a repeat fee as well. And if they have the cameras out, you know, sometimes the BBC films sessions for Red Button or for online, instead of £79 per member, you get £104 each, as I say, plus repeat fees if your sessions are aired again. And interestingly enough, and this is not a genre we've really covered, but in the classical realm, there are also fees which you can get from the BBC, including rehearsal fees and arrangement fees. So you can get money per minute of a classical song that you've helped arrange. But there you go. For straight radio play, probably around £70, but we'll update you. And that is why, ladies and gentlemen, Slade and Jonah Louis always look forward to Christmas. Where's here? Here's another one. Here's another 3 minutes.
He's always in the kitchen at parties counting his money. It's interesting for me, though, because like in my world, because the radio is obviously your area and streaming is mine. But one of the reasons you see people worrying about streaming money is because I think, and I always think of it as, so when you played on the radio, when you get a PPL payment, I believe it's split equally between the label and the artist. Is that correct? Or I think it's...
Do you know what? I'm not sure, but I can go and check. Yeah,
I think of it as that. So basically, as an artist, you get a bigger share of the money paid you for radio plays than you do of streaming if you're signed to a label. And so one of the big arguments driving the streaming debate is, what if people stop listening to the radio and listen to streaming instead? Does that mean suddenly you won't be getting those really nice payments from radio, but you'll be instead getting a smaller slice, depending on your label deal, of streams? And that's why we talked about equitable remuneration in a recent show. That was part of the debate there about if radio, the way radio pays is slightly different to streaming. Should we make streaming slightly more like that so that artists don't lose out if everyone crosses from radio? So there's kind of... that's what's driving that kind of these payments. So yeah, it has an effect in streaming.
And I think, as far as I know as well, the PRS, your PRS money will go straight to the band. So, I mean, certainly in the 90s, a lot of bands were just living off their PRS payments because record advances at the time had hit stupid levels. I mean, bands were demanding £100,000 advances, which... I mean, because there was so much money being spent on videos and promotion and all these other things, they were never going to recoup that £100,000 unless they sold, you know, they became a pretty big artist. So you were in debt, essentially, to your record company, because obviously the £100,000 advance is but a loan to you, the artist, which you eventually have to pay back. But they couldn't, they were struggling to get anywhere close to recouping. So their only income outside of playing live was PRS. And the amount of times you would see musicians out in Camden who had been skint the week earlier, who you hadn't seen for a while, out and about, do you want a drink? I thought you were skint. PRS checks arrived, and it was manna from heaven for a lot of, you know, writers then, because, you know, if you're unrecouped but you just recorded a session for Mark Goodyear's Evening Session or something, that money is going to come well in handy for you.
Mm. It does make you look back a bit. I remember reading about things like So-and-So Band have made a £1 million video. And yeah, that being quite exciting. And you see, now I think, God, that they'll never have earned that. I think it might have been the Dandy Warhols, Not If You're the Last Junkie on Earth, with the little dancing syringes. Right. I think that might have been a $1 million video. But, and then a few years later, they got that Vodafone ad with Bohemian Like You, which I believe, and this is maybe simplifying their finances, I believe that paid for them to buy their recording studio complex space.
Really?
in their hometown, really? Which is what's made them be able to be independent since, because they bought their own studio. And so it's interesting that thing of, you could have been completely in the hock to your advance because it was all spent on dancing syringes in your video. And then you're waiting for something to happen. It might be radio play, but it might be an advert, you know?
Yeah. We should, I mean, that's something that's, I don't know if anyone wants to ask this question or whether we will just do it off our own back, but we should do the money in having your music on a commercial, on an advert at some point, and then I'll be able to tell you the full story about the band Collapse Lung and their song Eat My Goal being used by Coca-Cola. That's one for another day. For now, that's where we'll leave it, I think. As I say, thank you very much. We'll be back in a few days' time. Thank you for all your questions. And if you have one of your own, drop us a line to the usual address, which is Stuart.
theprice of music podcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, thank you for listening. If you have enjoyed the show, as always, say, do subscribe in your podcast app, give us a review and a rating if you get a second. Tell your friends, spread the word. We're here every week, often twice a week. Thanks for your support. Till next time, take care.
Cheers.